Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
To another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. This is your host, Dan Weatherspoon. And in some ways, I guess I'm not going to fully be hosting this episode, as I've brought on a good friend of mine named Bill Turnbull. Bill had been on Mormon Matters before. It was the time that we talked about literal belief in Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve and all that stuff as it relates to the fall and the atonement. And Bill's a wonderful guest. And I had had a good meeting with a couple of friends up in Cache Valley about a month ago, and we got talking, and it just reminded me that it's been a long, long time on Mormon Matters since we visited the issues of addiction and recovery and the spirituality that's involved in all those things, and just the joy and all the things, certainly gospel-related, but also in some ways requiring a bit of change in dynamics that sometimes come into Mormon culture and family culture and things like that. And so as I was sharing the desire to have Bill come on with his wife Susan, because Bill and his wife are part of the LDS Addiction and Recovery Program as meeting facilitators and things like that, and to share their experiences on that, he goes, you know, you really need to have XYZ, and he named off a whole bunch of people that we should have on first to talk about addiction, maybe in a more raw way than just from the facilitators' perspectives and the things they're learning. And so Bill is going to be basically the main host for this podcast. I'll chime in from here and there. But he's brought on two good friends, and I'll have them all introduce themselves real quickly here. So, Bill, would you quickly give us an overview of who you are, what you do, and anything you want to say about these guys before we have them to introduce themselves?
Sure, Dan. Dan's a good friend, and it's fun to be back on the podcast again. Bill Turnbull, I am an Idahoan, grew up in Idaho, went to school at BYU, did my undergraduate and graduate work at BYU, kind of on the way to my PhD program, decided I better make some money and kind of got trapped in the business world and stayed there. So along the way, married a wonderful wife, my wonderful wife, Susan, and six kids. We've lived a bit all over, but we've settled in Utah now, in Midway. So we are, and one of the things we do, in terms of my church, I've been a lifelong member of the church. I consider myself maybe not an Orthodox, maybe not the most Orthodox Mormon, but certainly hopefully a devout and committed Latter-day Saint. And we currently serve as missionaries in the LDS Addiction Recovery Program, not facilitators, by the way. Facilitators are different. We'll get clear on that in a minute. Just need to correct you on that. Yeah. There's a key difference between, you know, we basically show up to run 12-step meetings. We set the meetings in motion, we close them, but the real work in 12-step meetings is between the participants and the facilitators. So we'll probably talk.
Yeah, addicts helping addicts, I know, is a key component of things. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, so we have Preston and Tyson Dixon, and I have to say that and they have a quite a remarkable story to tell. Susan and I got to know their parents, who are fellow missionaries with us, and we just have a great deal of respect, tremendous people, have a great deal of respect for them, and through them got to know Preston and Tyson. And maybe you guys give a brief introduction before we really dive into your story.
So, sure.
Whoever wants to go first.
Sure. Your oldest.
I'm Preston Dixon. I grew up in the church as well. I got involved with substances in high school, kind of fell way away from the church. Never really had a testimony until my addiction took me to the point where I had to really ask some tough questions. A lot of depression, some suicidal thoughts, lost a few really close friends to this disease of addiction, and was able to get treatment and get help and see hope and get inspired from those that had kind of gone before me, you know, got involved in recovery. And you know, it's interesting, Dan, when you mentioned the spirituality component, because that's really, you know, if I had to put my finger on one thing that was the biggest catalyst in helping me get clean and sober and into this world of recovery is spirituality, working the 12 steps of recovery. Since I've gotten sober, I've been able to go to school. I'm actually still in school working on my bachelor's at Argus University to get my SUDC, Substance Use Disorder Counselor, license. I'm currently the executive director at Renaissance Ranch Residential here in Bluffdale, Utah. And that's about me in a nutshell. I'm excited to kind of tell more of our story. Some of it will be pretty dark, but want to have fun. You know, there's a lot of fun, inspiring moments to my story. A lot of funny things. I'm excited to do this podcast with my brother. He's probably one of the funniest guys I know, and we'll try and have fun and keep it entertaining and be real at the same time.
Awesome.
Love you, bro. Yeah, appreciate the opportunity. So my name is Tyson Dixon, and you know, as my brother said, you know, it's you know, doing things like this for us, you know, is great. It's an aspect of our recovery to serve and give back to our community, and to God's children, you know, in the best way we can. I think I know that I could speak for both of us. I think we believe that we went through the hardship of addiction and nearly lost our lives and family nearly ripped to shreds for specific reasons and some specific purposes. And those reasons and purposes are manifesting themselves in our lives today. And it's a huge blessing. So thank you for the opportunity. And Bill, thanks for reaching out to us.
We're excited. Yeah. So do you want to either lead out, or do you, one of you just want to start with the nitty gritties?
Yeah. Why don't we hear their story, and then we'll talk about the nature of addiction and some of the things that, yeah, but why don't you first just kind of tell your story and take as much time as you need to tell that story. And
sure. Okay. Well, our stories are pretty similar. We'll probably maybe tag team and switch off throughout the story. If you want a very good, brief 2 or 3 minute story, Mormon Channel did a special on our story, and specifically highlighting Preston, which is very powerful and really inspiring. So I would check that out. But yeah, we raised in a traditional LDS, heavily active LDS home. With our parents' generation, and I think that the way, so by the way, we're both I'm 29, Preston's 30. So our parents' generation, specifically my dad, you know, he grew up and he had some different things happen in his life, going through a divorce and having some different dynamics with parents that weren't active, and he got converted to the church, you know, in seminary in his, I think, junior or senior year of high school. Went on a mission, but was very staunchly religiously active, and as with my mother, and these are two of the most amazing people, you know, and it might be neat in the future to hear all of this from their perspective. So it's hard to speak for them, but you know, I guess you could say we were raised in a shame-based environment. Shame-based family system where it wasn't okay to talk about feelings, wasn't okay to, you know, admit mistakes, or wasn't okay to break the rules. You know, we were those kids who, you know, it's like, oh, our curfew's 9 o'clock and our friends are giving us crap because, you know, our parents are making us be home, or, you know, we can't have sleepovers, or we can't, and it was all, you can't do this, can't, and so I think early on, we kind of learned that religion or the church or upbringing, it was a lot of you can't do's, and we didn't. I don't know if we really like understood why. when we did do something wrong, you know, it was the shame that was felt. And when we started to early on, you know, speaking for myself, got sexually active at a young age, 14, 15 years old, in the which any type of spirituality I had was stifled, but more so it was the whole run and hide. And I had felt that, you know, I mean, just showing up at church was, you know, frightening. You know, you sweat and, you know, like, oh, should I take the sacrament? I get, you know, and don't tell, you know, don't talk about it. Preston and I going through the same thing at the same time. We didn't talk, you know, we didn't talk to our parents. We, you know, it was keep, you know, we kept everything from them, from church leaders. And we were a completely different person at home than we were at school when we were with our peers.
How many brothers and sisters are involved here, and did they know anything about
it? So I'm the oldest of five. It goes me, and then Tyson's 18 months younger than I am. And then we had two sisters. We have two sisters, Shro and Shelby. And then the youngest is Jaron, and he all within 8 years.
Okay. But you two were the only ones who were like the cohort that were doing these sorts of things, and everybody else kind of was buying into the double life sort of stuff?
Yeah, he and I were the black sheep, I guess you could say. And we covered for each other and did different things. And then what happened is we started around that same time experimenting with drugs and alcohol. And I think we reacted to it a little bit different. And, you know, there's some things that were going on both neurologically and biologically. You know, it's scientifically proven that addiction is hereditary. It's got a genetic component. So our grandfather was an alcoholic. And so when we first drank or used drugs, we reacted to it differently than our friends did, I think. You know, our friends were, you know, we kind of took things to the next level and you know, participated in it more frequently and probably more amounts. There's two primary components when you consider addiction. There's that genetic component, and there's also the environmental component, the old nature and nurture, right? Well, the nurture component, which unbeknownst to us was a shame-based family system, we were kind of an environment we were in. So when we used the drugs and alcohol, it suppressed the shame and those feelings and perpetuated the use. At the time, we didn't really put two and two together. We were getting high because we liked getting high. That's what and why we thought. What we didn't know is that we had, from our decisions and the things that we were doing, we had deep emotional shame and guilt, and we were trying to mask that. And Preston, I'm sure, can speak to his.
Yeah, a lot of underlying causes and conditions. You know, just as I'm hearing this, I played soccer all growing up. Me and Tyson were both pretty heavily involved in sports. Tyson was an amazing athlete in football. I played soccer, and that was kind of my, I guess, sport of choice growing up. And I didn't make the high school team. You know, there was a huge void there. I was 16, and my whole life had ended in my mind. And this, you know, about that same time, you know, me and Tyson were both sneaking out at night, and you know, I was sexually active at 16, and talking about feeling shame and guilt, you know, and you know, I never really had a really firm testimony of Christ and of the church, but I had enough to know that I was screwing up. I knew I had feelings that. A lot of inadequacy, you know, in a kind of a shame-based family system, there's a lot of control that just rubbed me the wrong way, and I resisted naturally against that. And then the first time I used, a buddy gave me a couple Loratabs, and the most amazing thing happened. I felt good enough. I felt adequate. I felt okay. I couldn't figure out why wouldn't anybody take this? This is amazing. And that's kind of what started this cycle of addiction, at least with me. Mm-hmm. And then one thing led to another and to another. And you know, Tyson and I, like he mentioned, we would cover for each other because we didn't want mom to worry. You know, dad was more of an authoritative parenting, had more of an authoritative parenting style. Mom was more of a codependent, permissive type of style. We were easily able to manipulate our poor mom, and you know, both Tyson and I are mama's boys, and we're real close to mom. We didn't want her to worry, and it wasn't really until our addiction had got to the point where we were withdrawing heavily, and I'll never forget we were partying at a buddy's house. Tyson, I don't think you were there, but someone had mentioned that a friend of ours had overdosed and died. And that shook me pretty hard to the core.
So what were you doing at this party? What kind of drugs was it?
It was just a drinking type of, you know, social type of party. And someone had mentioned that he passed away, and I had known pretty well. And well, he overdosed on heroin is what happened. And I think his a friend of mine overdosed, and it shook me pretty hard. And you know, I started to think, man, you know, Tyson and I are both using. We weren't at that point where we're doing heroin yet, but that's kind of the beginning of where, you know, I became cognizant of, you know, I got a problem because I keep using these. I was at the point I was doing Oxycontin pretty regularly. And I think Ty was doing probably the same thing there.
So you got Preston got into the more hardcore opiates. Mm-hmm. I was a weed guy. You know, I started smoking weed at 15. By the time of my junior year, I was smoking weed every day. I was leaving, you know, seminary is like a free class, you know. You'd go and get baked and come back to seminary or lunchtime. But every day it was an occurrence. The weekend it was drinking a lot. I got put on probation when I was 17. Didn't get off probation until I was 21. So I was really trying to dodge the system. And, you know, Preston had started to, like he's saying, started to question himself and his addiction. Well, you know, I didn't. That was not my perception. I was going the other way. And like Preston said, I was, you know, an athlete in high school, and you know, I was a 190-pound linebacker and a running back, and still trying to manage my addiction at that point. It wasn't an addiction to me, but just what I did. But what had happened was, you know, 9 months after I graduated high school, I was full blown addicted to heroin, and I got to the point where, fast forward through the progression of drug use, 9 months later, I found myself in a jail cell, 120 pounds, withdrawing from cold turkey from heroin. So it was. You know that those, you know, Book of Mormon cartoons, the Living Scripture videos where the prodigal son found himself in rags with nothing in his pocket, with no one to look to, you know, eating out of the pig trough. And he kind of came to himself and was just, right, what have I become?
Yeah.
I felt that feeling, and that's who I had become. And in a very quick amount of time. I mean, it was, so it happened quick. What had happened is Preston and I were going to UVU, partying. We got kicked out of, BYU approved housing in 3 or 4 months. And we just were idiots, man. looking back,
throwing a kegger in a BYU approved place is really,
yeah, bad. Oh, man. When there's beer cans everywhere, that's a dead giveaway, you know. And you've got your friends outside, anyway. So but what had happened is, you know, I went from smoking marijuana every day, many times a day, to trying heroin, smoking heroin. You know, I'm gonna just give this a shot, see what all the hype is. Because this weed isn't really cutting it for me anymore. I immediately quit smoking marijuana altogether. and started smoking heroin almost every day.
About the same time, OxyContin was, there was a lot of doctors that were getting in trouble and the supply, was getting scarce. And I remember, I think it was like the week before Christmas. It was in December.
Yeah.
And I was in, we were in the truck and you said, here, just try the heroin. And, and I did, I remember thinking it's cheaper. It's the same thing. And that's kind of what started. And the interesting thing is with the heroin is it grabbed a hold of me really strong. I was able to kind of be a functioning addict with the OxyContin. And with the heroin, it took 3 months where me and Tyson had lost a ton of weight. We didn't trust each other. We're best friends. We were hiding things from each other. We were different people. We were stealing Levi's 501s and 509s from different places and trading to the Mexican mafia for heroin balloons. We were involved in some pretty scary stuff.
It just turns us into complete, criminal thieves. It completely rewires your midbrain. And after studying addiction and being so interested in that, and after going to jail and treatment facilities, they tell me I have a disease. And in my recovery, I've studied that thoroughly, and I'm glad I did. It's done a lot for my recovery, but I didn't know at the time we were in the grips of a literal neurological brain disease. We did not have control over ourselves.
We weren't thinking of the consequences. We weren't thinking past that day. People think what they're going to do next week or the next month or their life goals. And when you're in your midbrain, you're just trying to think how you can get through the end of the day. And when you wake up the next day and you're withdrawing, the only thing that's on your mind is you've got to use. And for me, it got to the point where I felt I had to use more than eat breakfast.
Yeah.
It's an obsession of the mind and your body, everything in you just, it looks at it as life, like the air that you need to breathe. And
you disregard anybody else, anybody's feelings, anybody's needs.
You don't really feel. You're not really – your frontal cortex, you're not processing emotions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll talk about that brain, kind of how that works in the brain in just a minute. Anything you'd like to add to your story and what you're
– Absolutely. That was all the bad parts. Let's get to the good parts.
And what were you – How much of this did your parents know was going on at this time? Like when it got
Bad? With where was that? Is like I mentioned, we didn't want mom and dad to know. Certainly not mom. Mm. Dad, we were already kicked out of the house. We were living in a cold basement with no windows, which is perfect for a drug addict because when you wake up, it's still dark. It's great. But it got to the point for me where I was really scared. I didn't really care about my life, but I felt a stewardship to my younger brother. By this time, were we both on heroin, we lost a few other friends to the disease, I was kind of the point where I knew that if we didn't get help soon, one or both of us was going to die. When you're waking up violently shaking and you're sweating and you're throwing up your own bile, you're in a bad spot. So I remember I remember we're sitting in the kitchen on the kitchen table at our house in Draper, and I remember wanting to bring it up with my mom, Tyson grabbed me and said, "No, we're not telling her." Yeah. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. I wanted to, addiction thrives in secrecy. I didn't want the jig to be up. Preston was done, I remember one time we were riding away from stealing a bunch of stuff to get drugs, and we prayed that the cops wouldn't catch us. We were like, let's say a prayer.
So you still have that
history. Let's say a prayer. The insanity. And so it got to the point where our parents knew we were on drugs. They knew, and we lost. We committed. They knew it. They didn't know what we were doing, and they'd never seen this before. They didn't know what to do. And so they called a couple people, and they got briefed. They were told that, hey, you got to tell them that either they get help and you're willing to help them if they want to be honest and accept the help, and if not, they can't live there, they can't stay there. It was the hardest thing, I think, looking back, for my parents to do. But in that moment, we were at that house, at our house, and my parents knew, and my mom was crying, and she's, what are you doing? We know you're taking, you're on drugs. Just tell me what drugs. Just tell me what drugs it is. Preston's like, I'm going to tell him, like, don't say a thing. Just tell him we're smoking weed and drinking, you know. Because they'd known that for a little bit. We'd got busted a few different times. And Preston goes, I can't take it anymore. We're using heroin. We're smoking heroin. And then they, well, what does that mean? What does that do to you? And then Preston just, he let the whole cat, all the cat, he was ready to change at that point. I wasn't. And that's an important piece of our story and how we both find recovery. That he was ready. He was ready. I wasn't.
Well, before this too, Ty, the family had done an intervention on us.
Yeah.
And
it was a bit hazy on that.
I wasn't. I think you're out of your mind. But we were, and this is kind of where I was at. You know, my view was, I just want to use when I want to. It made me feel, good. It made me feel adequate. It gave me, at times, but, also it was where the withdrawals, where I knew I needed help, but it's such a battle when you're in your addiction, you're really not thinking clearly. I wasn't thinking clearly. And I thought it was just, I was just harming myself. I thought we were just doing it. I wasn't hurting anybody else. Right. A million ways to justify being an addict. Million way. I mean, if you want to find a reason, you can find a reason. But what really was probably one of the significant turning points for me was during that intervention when they're going around, each of our family members were talking to us. I was pretty angry. I was pretty resentful. I we were lying a lot at that point. We were telling them we were just smoking weed and drinking and just leave us alone. And, we're not hurting anybody. And, we yada, 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 yada. Mm-hmm. But then my little brother, Jaron, he was probably around 12 years old at the time. I was, oh man, he's maybe more like 10. Yeah, no, I was 20. We're 8 years apart. So he's 12. And he looked at me and he had tears in his eyes. And, he was choked up and I got a little choked up. I remember him just talking about how he wants his brother back, mm-hmm. And that's when, I felt for the first time in a little while at that point, cause you don't feel much when you're using. And I felt remorse. I felt guilt, but deeper than that, I felt almost a little bit of, it was a healthy form of shame that motivated me that, okay, I need to change because you're right, Jaron, I have been isolating. I haven't been around you. I haven't been involved. We weren't going around. We weren't involved in family activities. We tried to stay away from the family because we felt that shame and guilt when we were around the family.
So there's kind of this moment of clarity in this long fog, basically. Mm-hmm. And you didn't choose to numb that feeling this time. You kind of sat with it, maybe, and felt it, and it managed to somehow change your course a little bit.
Yeah, it's kind of where I realized I'd been selfish. Mm-hmm. I'd been being selfish, and it wasn't just affecting me. It was affecting, if it was just affecting Jaron, it was affecting more people than myself. And it's kind of, a 20-year-old kid hooked on heroin, that was, one of many just sobering type of interactions that made me feel that, I shouldn't be doing this. Yeah. This is not a good thing.
And it was about that time where, my parents had asked what the next steps were, and, the next step was to detox from the drugs. And they'd said, we're going to help you, and, we're going to go get you detoxed. And Preston, at that time, Preston was ready. I wasn't, I basically went into detox, in a medical detox in hospital. I found myself in a drug treatment program 3 days later, and Preston was in a different drug treatment program. And I had no idea that I was going to be staying in a drug treatment program. I thought I was going to go somewhere for a couple days. And they told me it was a 30-day to 60-day program. And I was just not ready. And
it wasn't your idea.
Not my idea. Mm-hmm. I woke up in this house and I didn't know really how I got there, mm-hmm. what was going on. I'm like, hey, it's about 60 days. Like, well, see you later. And I took off, and
he actually came to my rehab to try and quote unquote bail me out.
Yeah, sure, I went to save him. Yeah, I went to save him from rehab.
Just insanity.
Yeah, Yeah. And they called the cops on me, and then Preston stayed in treatment and he started getting help. I went the opposite direction and used more drugs than I ever have before, and went further and further down, and luckily got incarcerated. That is when I was in that moment.
For stealing, for what they arrested for?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was. I had went and stole some things from a department store, and I had the staff of the store and the pedestrians hold me down until the police arrived.
Mm. Now, you'd be a hard guy to hold down now, but
like I said, I was 120 pounds.
You were 120 pounds.
Yeah, so, yeah. 240 pounds today.
You're half the man.
Got a couple to shed right now, but no, it was so demoralizing. You talk about, incomprehensible demoralization. About, I felt like old Yeller after he got infected. I felt like a stray animal with rabies. I mean, I felt like lower, and then being incarcerated and the drugs wore off.
Mm.
And then I was in a state of acute physical withdrawal. I finally learned what projectile vomit was, like literally. I remember feeling just burning hot, sweating, but freezing cold. Like the hottest you've ever found yourself in a steam room you can't get out, sauna you can't get out of, or being in Antarctica butt naked at the same time.
Yeah.
That's no exaggeration. That's how it felt. And then you have all the muscle pains, the bone, it hurts to just be. You feel like you get hit by a truck and you have to move. But the physical pain and agony, the sleeping, you can't sleep. I didn't sleep literally. I was up 24 hours a day because when you use excessive opiates, you're when you come off of them, your brain doesn't have the natural opiates to put you to sleep. And so you literally stay up around the clock. And I stayed up for about 20 days straight.
Oh, wow.
I was awake. I had essentially after the fifth, sixth, I had accepted I wasn't going to sleep. Stayed up all night, played a lot of solitaire. And and I was in maximum security at that point because I had punched someone when I got arrested trying to get away. And if you do anything like that when you get arrested, you do go into maximum security. And that's where I was at. This is Salt Lake County Jail. So in a cell for 23 hours a day, around the clock, going through this physical pain and agony, the no sleep. My roommate was a sociopath, legitimately. The physical agony and pain was nothing compared to the emotional pain and the spiritual pain that I was feeling and that I was experiencing. It was as if, when the drugs wore off and I literally felt like I had snapped out of a dream, and into a nightmare. And that dream was all real. This isn't who I am. A year ago, I was playing football. I was, I graduated high school somehow, but I did. What have I become? Then I started to think about all the things that I had done, all the places we had stolen from, the lies we had told, the pain that I saw in my mother's eyes. I could feel now, but I couldn't feel then. The pain with my brother. I'm saying, where did my brother go? I'd go out every day after school and throw the baseball with my brother, throw the football with my little brother, and the friends, I had a host of friends and people, and it was $130 for me to get bailed out of jail. Not one person, would do it, would get me out. I had burned every bridge with everyone I had ever had. I burned the bridge with my parents. I'm so thankful they left me in jail and they didn't bail me out. And I was able to go through that. That was my Gethsemane, my rock bottom. Grateful for that experience. That was the lowest I've ever been, and I hope to ever be. And it was at that point I received a letter from my brother in jail, and he started talking about things like we could find we could find God, that he had found God, that he had found a higher power, is how he put it, and that it wasn't the same shaming, wrathful God that we had been raised to understand who God was. You know, he told me that we could have our own conception and our own understanding and our own relationship with that higher power. And that was very foreign to me. And a spark happened within my heart. And that spark was hope in that my brother could do it. Maybe I could, you know, this person can do it. Maybe I could. And, that started our journey. Well, I was able to get out of jail. Finally, I was able to get out and in that state, I was, still spiritually lost. It wasn't an immediate, I was healthy and ready to go. I told myself, I'm never going to use heroin again. This pain that I've gone, that's why would I ever do that? Well, but I'm still going to drink and smoke pot and do other stuff. But I'm not going to, and a month later I was using heroin again. I know why now. I did not then. The progression of the disease and when it was reignited in my brain and had gotten back to that point and it was at that point, luckily, my parents and a crafty legal defender who helped to save me, who I still keep in touch with. But they worked it out to where if I went to a drug treatment program, I wouldn't have to return to jail, but I had to complete that program. So I did really kind of at first against my will, just doing it for the courts, just doing it for my parents. With the hope that my brother had instilled in me. I remember before I went to that treatment program, I remember asking Press, tell me, tell me, because I thought he was still the same guy. I said, Press, tell me everything I got to do to get out of this, to appease these people, everything I got to do to make everything go good.
So shortcuts.
I was like, hey, tell me what the shortcuts are, easier, softer way. And he had changed at that point. He had changed. I could see it in his eyes. And I knew at that point he wasn't going to enable me. He was a different guy. And he looked at me with a smile on his face. And he just said, bro, knowing the pain and the progress I needed to make and go through, he looked at me and he said, you just need to just surrender, bro. Just surrender. What does that mean? Who are you? What is going on? And I learned what that meant. A few weeks later, I nearly got kicked out of the treatment facility for not obeying the rules, not being there for genuine ways. And the group of individuals that I was in treatment with, they spoke of a higher power the same way my brother did. The people that had been as helpless and hopeless as I was, the people that seemed like they had hope, seemed like they had a glimmer in their eye, they all talked about a higher power, and they all talked and said that was the one of the main cause that had helped them, their heart to change and minds to change, and where they feel peace. And most amazing is that they said that they didn't feel the desire to use drugs and alcohol, which I thought was insane because that's all I could think about on a consistent basis. And I remember one group where they said, the message I heard was, if you don't find God, you're going to eventually die. And I stayed up late that night just praying. And I prayed this time, that night, for the first time in my life. Like I said, I grew up in an LDS household. But I'm telling you, I prayed that night for the first time in my existence on this earth.
You had said a lot of prayers before that.
Said a whole lot of prayers with my head, Prayers like, bless the food, name Jesus Christ, amen. And, bless the, I didn't believe in anything when I was praying. This time I had to believe. It was at that place of desperation and place of, if there is anything out there, I need you now more than ever. I am nothing and no one. I cannot change on my own. I cannot I remember specifically praying to see the world as God sees it, see it through a different perspective, see myself in a different way. And because the way that I was viewing life and the way I was thinking and had led me to where I was with nothing and no one and no future. I was at that point where I couldn't imagine my life not using drugs and alcohol. I grasped to that and I thought that's who I was going to be. But I knew if I continued down that path, I knew that night I would end up in prison or dead. I knew that's what the outcome would be, but I couldn't fathom living a life sober. I couldn't fathom living in recovery and being happy. How is that possible? I didn't want to be like these goody two-shoe Peter Priested dudes. I didn't fit in with them. Never want to be them. I don't want to be that kind of person, you know? And today I'm a heavily active LDS, proud member of the church today with a genuine and depth relate and a deep relationship with my Heavenly Father and my Savior. But I didn't comprehend that at the time. I was just lost and broken. But I knew that if something didn't change, I was a goner, no doubt. And God comes to some people over time. Sometimes He comes to people quickly. Sometimes, you know, He appears to a grove and to a 14-year-old boy. Or sometimes someone doesn't go through their Gethsemane in their 50s or 60s, or go through cancer later in life, or whatever it might be. Everyone has their own journey that's unique and personal to them. But the next day, after I said that genuine prayer with faith and believing, I felt God and angels around me the next day, and my heart and my mind opened up in a dramatic fashion, and the Spirit poured into me, and I was learning in a rapid manner. I had finally become humble. My favorite scripture is Ether 12:27, and I was given the weakness of addiction that I might be humble and be brought into that state. And it has that weakness has through the grace of the Savior has been made strong, and has enabled me to live a life beyond my wildest dreams today.
The family. Beautiful kids.
I've got an amazing, amazing wife and best friend and two beautiful children. And I've got a mortgage. I got a home. They let me get a home, and you know, I've got a car. And
it's weird when you get good credit.
I build my credit up. I went to school and I got educated, but I learned how to live life clean and sober. And live life on life's terms. I worked the steps. I worked the 12 steps, which are essentially eternal principles, and in reality is the process of the atonement. Yeah. And I experienced genuine dramatic change. And you know, I was sober for a year and a half, relapsed, and that's when I came into Renaissance Ranch, and that was September 16th, 2008. And I've been blessed to be clean and sober since. I've been more blessed to experience a genuine depth of happiness and freedom and peace and joy and love in sobriety and in life today. And I could talk so much, but that is for me what happened when I was in that place of despair and darkness. And I have a testimony that as we reach out to God in those times, in those moments, with faith, He will manifest Himself in our lives, and that's just truth. And that's been awesome, and that's been and I know Preston, you know, has a similar experience, and is told with a great deal of power. Again, is on that Mormon channel on step two. But
yeah, so there's a series of videos on the 12-step program on the Mormon channel, and they're fantastic, by the way, really inspiring. And Preston's story is kind of told in very
well. There's a lot of stories that are told. A lot of those facilitators, you know, I was a facilitator for a long time, really active as a facilitator. I've been real busy with the ranch since, but I got to know Lindsay Titus. A lot of those people that did those stories are very, you know, they've got very powerful stories. A few of those people I don't know, but
12 Steps to Change. If you go to YouTube, type in 12 Steps to Change. Yeah. They'll pop up. But, you know, I remember when I was in treatment and Tyson was, I had found out that he wasn't in treatment like I thought he was in the family group. And I was scared. You know, I was scared to death because me and Tyson were pretty enmeshed at the time. We were pretty much all each other had. And after losing a few friends to this disease, you know, it was very, very just so scary. I remember hitting my knees a lot and you know, really grateful for the disease of addiction because it got me to the point where, like I mentioned before, I had to ask some very real questions. You know, I'm a ward missionary now and I go out and I meet with different people, and I was just talking to a friend of mine who has a calling with me, and a lot of people, you know, they don't search for God or for religion until, you know, there's a refiner's fire somewhere, until they've lost somebody or in times of crisis or a time of need. And you know, my story is very similar to Ty's as far as, you know, my second week in treatment, I was feeling everything. I was depressed. I was emotional. I was crying over everything and feeling a lot of guilt, beating myself up for not visiting my grandparents, you know, in 2 years or, you know, just all those things. And when I hit my knees and I asked God if he was really there and he cared about me after, you know, preparing for probably six hours, reading the scriptures, reading the enzymes, and I had to know. And I was fortunate enough to really feel God's love, just so pure and so, you know, you just can't really describe it. You know, you just can't quantify really the feeling. You just, when it happens, you just know. You know, you know that, all right, he's really there. He cares about me. You know, I felt more peace. And this is after not sleeping for 2 weeks. Like Ty mentioned with the opiates, you just, when you're withdrawing from those. And I was able to sleep after that prayer, after, you know, left a whole night's sleep. I woke up the next day, same thing like Ty said. I felt like I had, you know, strength that wasn't my own. I felt like I, you know, as I meet with guys now, you know, that are struggling with this disease, you know, so many of them try to do it on their own. They try to battle it. You know, they don't have to. You know, the guy upstairs is there. You just got to reach out to him.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting to watch these two brothers tell the story, and especially knowing the family, because I'm sure they would have looked like they're the family that you want to put on the ensign cover. You know, they're a well-educated, very nice-looking family. You know, this is. If people saw you sitting in sacrament meeting, they would say, I wish I could be that family when you guys were, you know, in your early teens and, you know, because dedicated to the gospel, you know, life going well. You talk about growing up in this. Well, I want to say one thing before I move on to this, but, no, I know Dan, we have conversations, and I know on your podcast, there are a lot of conversations, where, you know, we talk about faith, we talk about doubt. They almost become intellectual exercises. When you're listening to stories of people really deep in addiction, at that point, faith is much more than an intellectual exercise. It's the difference between living and dying.
Absolutely.
Whether God is real is a difference between and can touch you is a difference between a completely shattered life. Uh-huh. Or, sure. You know, or wholeness.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that's where the atonement of Jesus Christ is, maybe in its rawest, but most transformative, in evidence, in its most transformative and raw state, I would say. And I see that in this family. I want to talk just a little bit. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but you guys talked about, how addiction happens in the brain. And you made reference to your midbrain, for example. And I know there are brain structures in the middle of your brain that sort of drive addictions. And what we think of as the part of the brain where maybe reason and judgment reside gets completely pushed out of the way in addiction. You want to just briefly kind of explain how that works?
But before we do, I kind of want to mention that a lot of things that we're going to say – we've learned from Dr. Kevin McCauley. Got to give him some credit.
And Dr. Corey Rich and
sure,
and
sure.
And you know, the science of addiction, which is really new. The medical community hasn't really doctors. This is why we're in a prescription drug epidemic right now. It's because it's misunderstood and you know, we're not doctors, we're not neurologists, but we have experienced what it's like to be in that diseased state, and we have studied it. You know, in fact, in going and getting my degree in psychology, I was able to really focus on a specific area of psychology, and I focused on addiction. I wrote many different papers and really, really kind of dissected it. And I've come to understand it in a fairly, for me, I've kind of really made it simple, you know, but yet it's amazing how it happens. But we need to understand that addiction isn't just a physical disease or a brain disease. It is, but it's also mental. In totality, it's mental, emotional, physical, and spiritual. So while we have these physical aspects going on, if you look back and listen with what happened to our story, you can see the spiritual implications of when we were essentially filled with the adversary and had no light coming in and were completely misled. So that is a very real, there's a very real unseen component with addiction that if you don't address that, and that's what we do, we have done within the church's 12-step program within Alcoholics Anonymous, and on a professional level with proven clinical methods within Renaissance Ranch and Renaissance Ranch Outpatient. Because you've got to understand what you're dealing with. You've got to address and treat the individual on all those levels. But what's very specific and very important for people to know, is how it works in the brain. So the midbrain was mentioned. That's in the amygdala. It's the part of the brain that regulates our survival. It's known as the fight or flight part of the brain. It's the part of the brain that tells the heart to beat, your lungs to breathe. You know, the same part that tells you you need to eat to survive. You need to sleep. To kill or be killed. It's the primitive. It's the same part of the brain that really all animals have, including us as humans. So that's the instinctual part of the brain.
And the pleasure centers also reside there.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what tells you what's good and what's not good, what to repeat and what not to repeat. And then you've got the other part of the brain, which is the logical, reasoning, value-based part of the brain. It's the prefrontal cortex. And this part of the brain is something that's exclusive to humans, at least in the manner it's developed, of course. It enables our brain and enables us to strategize, enables us to comprehend sense of right and wrong, where our morals and relatively it's believed where our spirituality relies and passes through as well. Well, when an individual, when we first use drugs and alcohol, that is a moral sin, if you will. We'll take that, you know, and this isn't a theory, this is science, and it's not meant to alleviate or absolve the addict.
But it's a choice. At that level, when you first say drugs, it's a choice, it's the wrong thing to do. Yeah.
Absolutely. Then you implement the genetic components, right, which can be passed down, addiction being hereditary, and then you implement environmental factors, you know, where you find yourself. If someone has experienced trauma or abuse, and so when they use it, it fills in all the emotional cracks, so to speak, and is a temporary band-aid to emotional pain. So what'll happen is what happens in the brain is it communicates that this is good, this is positive, and go ahead and let's continue that. And what happens is I kind of like to look at it as a spectrum or a scale, to where once the scale is tipped on one end, and you cross into the line of addiction, what I like to look at it is little by little the prefrontal cortex starts to shut down. It starts to constrict. It goes darker and darker and darker.
The actual blood flow starts to move more towards
toward the midbrain structures.
And even in your organs. I mean, it's just kind of like if you're you know, if you're about to get in a fight, you know, it's, your adrenaline goes. There's a real chemical, biological reaction that happens.
Mm. Yeah. So these drugs are stroking the pleasure centers of the brain.
Correct.
And develop patterns that over time essentially screen out the prefrontal part of the brain, and you lose the ability to reason. I think one of the interesting things that, and we all do this, and I'm sure your parents did this, and you did this yourself. I'm sure you asked yourself this question many times: what am I doing? Why am I doing this? And people in your lives say, because you make these appallingly immoral decisions that appear to be decisions. Mm-hmm. But they're really not decisions. At a certain point.
And what baffles people that have a normal functioning brain is why?
Why?
Don't you see the obvious damage and the negative consequences that causes? Don't you see? And the answer is no. They don't.
They don't see it.
Yes. They can't. They're incapable. Part of their brain that enables them to do is gone radio silent. It's dark.
So addiction becomes this ability. Addiction essentially... You define it at a certain point as losing the ability to choose. You lose that ability to make choices and to see consequences of decisions, because all you can think about. I remember Tyson. I heard you tell a story or use the analogy that, you know, when you're 20 feet underwater.
Yeah.
I mean, you remember that?
I mean, and this is kind of a good analogy. I think everybody's jumped off of a high dive or, you know, have been, you know, way underwater and found yourself completely out of breath looking up at the waterline. And, you know, at that point, your lungs are screaming for air. Your brain needs oxygen. At that moment, what's the one thing you're thinking about? You know, you're thinking about doing whatever you got to do to get to the top and get a breath of air so you can survive. That's what the brain is communicating to you. You need to live, so you need to get air. You're not thinking about what you're going to make for dinner later that night. You know, you're not thinking about working things out with your relationship or anything like that. You've got one thing on your mind and one thing only, and that is to survive.
I got to get to that top, and I got to have air, and that is essentially what it's like being in addiction.
That's exactly what it feels like being addiction. But there's so much more to it. But essentially, that is the same. I feel that is the same way the brain, in the same way an addict feels, is they need that substance. And it goes back to like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And it goes to the top. When an individual is addicted, it becomes more important than food, than relationships, than security, than all of those things. It becomes the primary focus for survival.
Yeah. Okay. So I think one thing we all do, because we all have addicts in our lives, we all know addicts, you know, either in our families or friends, and we just can't believe that they make, and we talk about it in terms of making choices.
Yeah.
But really, the range of choices you can make as you descend into addiction becomes so very narrow. And really, what is it that gives you at some point that power to make a choice again? Because recovery, what I found is recovery is sort of that step-by-step process during which you recover the ability to choose.
Mm.
You
absolutely.
That's really kind of what it is.
You
recover bit by bit. It doesn't happen all at once. It doesn't come in one big stroke. You had an epiphany, and it somehow you thinking about your brother touched your heart, and you had that moment of clarity, and you had that little bit of choice to make, and you acted on that choice. You could have chosen otherwise. You could have numbed, because it was kind of painful to think of your brother, because that's what you'd always done, is numbed, right? Mm-hmm. But you didn't, and grace kind of entered in there, and that gave that little wedge for the atonement to sort of enter into your life and for change to happen. Every story of real recovery is like that.
Yeah.
And oh, by the way, you're all good now, right?
No.
Everything's good? No, never any problems anymore?
No, that's important to know, you know. I thought I was good the first time I went to treatment. I had that amazing spiritual experience that I told you about.
Yeah.
I read the Book of Mormon at that time. You know, I'd never read it. You know, they said, read it, you know. and find out if it's true. We'd heard that all growing up, and I'd finally have an open heart, and I was like, I'm gonna read this here thing, see what this is all about, you know. See if this is true. And boy, is it ever. And you can't read that book with an open heart seeking truth and not be filled and know that it's true. And then that's what happened, and I had my patriarchal blessing in there, and that was to this date the most powerful spiritual experience I have ever had. these amazing experiences. I wanted to serve a mission at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Strived, and I didn't think that I disregarded the professionals and the experienced individuals that had told me, you need to work the steps, you need to get involved in service, you need to get a sponsor, you need to continue with meetings, you need to continue to treat your disease. See, I thought at that point I had completely changed.
Yeah, you had this spiritual transformation. You thought, this is good, and I'm good.
And I thought I was good. I thought, you know, most people, they have a disease, they might have this or that. I'm different. You know, I'm me. I'm going to go ahead and conquer the world now. And a year and a half later, I was using again, despite the miraculous change. And that was baffling at the time. And what I had learned is that we're, once an individual's brain is affected to that magnitude, that it's my belief that we will never be cured of addiction. However, we can have our addiction be put in remission.
Yeah.
And as long as we consistently treat ourselves and heal and work on our recovery on those levels, emotionally, mentally, physically, and spiritually, we will keep the disease in remission.
And that's why addicts in recovery often attend 12-step meetings for years and years, and some for the rest of their lives.
It's not stuff we have to do. Yeah. It's stuff we get to do and we enjoy doing because it's spiritually fulfilling and socially fulfilling. And it enables us to be better husbands,
yeah,
better wives, better in our businesses, it's, better in yeah, our lot, in every aspect.
It's so easy for this world to beat us up.
Yeah.
You know, it's so easy to be a natural man. It happens to me constantly where, you know, I slack off on my recovery. Happens too much.
Mm.
And I'll begin to feel anxieties. I get short with my wife, short with my kids, easy to anger, you know, and it's always upsetting when my wife points it out. She's very sensitive. She'll point out, Preston, you need to go to meet, or Preston, we need to read scriptures. That's typically what it is.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like I don't want to go to church. Heck, I'll level with you guys. Most Sundays, getting two kids ready for church and that whole battle with the 1 o'clock church time with no nap. I don't want to go half the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to go. But every time I go, I feel the spiritual gifts after, and I feel good and at peace, and I'm glad I went.
Yeah.
Every time. No one ever, you know, goes to church and after think that was a horrible idea.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. I've had that thing.
Yeah. Talking to the wrong people. Yeah.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.